So, we started by noticing where we were at, basically. Bringing our attention to what can be really taken for granted and so obvious that we don't notice it, of just being in a room full of people that have similar intentions. And, you know, there were a lot of people here. And that has its own kind of feeling, its own kind of energy. It supports our practice. It makes us know that we're not alone. We have come out to be with each other. It can be a really nice feeling. And even if you're not speaking to the other people in the room so much, we just get a sense of being surrounded and hopefully feeling safe in the space that we're in. So I think it's really important to acknowledge, especially when we gather as a community, to acknowledge how that feels. Because part of that feeling is why we come. Or part of the reason that we come is to experience the feeling of being in a room full of people who have similar intentions. So we acknowledge that. We acknowledge the space that we're in and how that feels. Irregardless of whether we're communicating verbally or not. And then we checked in a little bit to how our body was feeling, how our hearts are doing right now, how our mind is doing. And that plays a really important role in a couple of ways. It could be considered a form of self-care. It can be considered a form of self-reflection. Self-awareness. And what we do with that awareness is pivotal and key. If we don't check in with ourselves, we don't really assess our own landscape, how are we going to make decisions or choices about what might be best for us at any given time? We don't very well. We might ride on assumptions or, you know, things that have gone on in the past. We might ride on rote behavior or habit, even though that's no longer maybe the most skillful thing to do. So by checking in and noticing how we are, body, heart, mind, then we have this potential to relate to ourselves more immediately and on a moment-to-moment basis. It makes it more real. And it's also a source of insight and wisdom. We begin to have insights about, oh, well, my body feels like this, my heart feels like this, my mind is like this. The combination, or separately, however we want to put it together, or unpack it and take it apart, all comes in one way or another to lead us towards doing one thing maybe or another because of what we've noticed. So when it comes to practice, this gives us a lot of opportunity to choose the practice that might be the best for us right now. You know, the way we practice or the techniques that we use don't have to be the same every single day or whenever it is that you practice. It can vary. So for instance, I brought up the possibility of focusing on breath. Now, that's a very traditional way to practice, isn't it? I mean, probably most of you do that, at least for a time. The breath is always with us. We can sense it in one place or another. And we can focus our mind on it. Now, maybe not for very long. It can be quite slippery. But it is something that is always there, and we can choose at any time to focus in on it. And that can harness the mind, especially if we're feeling really scattered. So some of you might have chosen to do that. If you didn't know there was a choice, then I think that this is great information. Because sometimes you may not be wanting, or it may not be the right time because of things that have presented themselves in your life, where you are right now. Maybe breath isn't the best focus for you for this particular session, whatever that is. Do you know what I mean? So breath, focusing on breath is if we were a camera aperture, let's say, when we focus in on the breath, it's like narrowing the aperture to focus more intently on something. Gathering the mind, it can be also thought of. But maybe we're feeling a little tight. Maybe we're feeling a little constricted. A little contracted. The body feels contracted, the mind feels contracted, the heart feels contracted. So maybe focusing in on something isn't exactly the most skillful thing for now. So that's what I offered, sound. Because when we listen to sound, when we're receiving sound, it can be. Now, it's not for everybody. Nothing is for everybody in the same way, right? But it can be quite spacious because you're hearing a sound up on the ceiling, coming from outside, down on the floor, inside your belly, you know, from your neighbor, whatever. So it's all around the sound. And in order to really listen, you have to make that intention, and your mind goes, your awareness goes towards the sounds wherever they are. So it can take us out of feeling tight and narrow and constricted, and it can open us up. It can create a little bit more of a spacious feeling. And then I also offered paying attention to sensation. And I said, in quotes, it gives us something to do. And that's because when you're noticing sensations around your body, you're busy, you know, in a sense. Because there's lots of them, right? There might be a little itch at the scalp, a little pressure under the leg, maybe you're getting little tingles in your foot, maybe you feel breathing up here, you know, maybe your pants are too tight, whatever. But you're feeling things, yeah? And so, essentially, the mind is just kind of waiting for the next sensation, and the next sensation goes, hey, come feel me, and you go down here. Oop, there's something over here. Okay, I'm going to go feel that. Oh, back here. Oh, over here. And so it's a little active. And there's this big territory to move around in. So sometimes I call mindfulness of sensation moving the mind. Because the mind moves towards, or awareness moves towards the sensation wherever it is until the next one calls it. So that can be also sort of a way to harness the mind and give it something, you know, kind of juicy. Because all the sensations are a little different. But none of those offerings, you know, either breath or sound or mindfulness of sensation is for everybody. You know, some people don't want to pay that much attention to their bodies. Some people associate sounds too much and, oh, I like this and I don't like that, so it's not really that relaxing. know, some people really like to pay attention to breath and some people don't. So it's good to know that there are choices, and I think it's also very helpful to know why we might choose one or another, depending on how we are. Now, we're not going to know how we are unless we check in. So we go back to that, right? So you might have chosen one or, oh, and then there was open awareness. And that's also called choiceless awareness. Did any of you practice that? So that's a little, that just sort of, after a while, after you've been practicing for a while, you might just experience choiceless awareness without trying. Where your awareness is broad enough to take in whatever's happening. Could be a sound, could be a sensation, feeling, could be an emotion, it could be a thought, it could be the breath, it could be a smell, it could be some sight. And what we end up doing, really, that practice of open awareness, it's called choiceless awareness, is being aware of what's arising and passing as it's arising and passing. So without saying to the mind, okay, I want you to focus in here or I want you to widen out here, it's just taking whatever the present moment entails as practice. Observing it, being with it. So if you've not tried that before, you might try that once in a while. Just what's it like to be alive right now? Basically, that's kind of how I see it. What's here? Okay, that's part of practice. Without preference. Yeah? So those are just four types of practices within the Vipassana tradition. So there's lots. Lots of mindfulness practices, lots of skillful means, lots of different ways to wake up, train the mind, be in the present moment, work with how we feel, develop, you know, more skills for living. All of that's included. Yeah? And then when we, towards the end, we took about almost 10 minutes to experience the real felt sense of the body and breath, either with eyes opened or eyes closed. Did anybody open their eyes for that part? Okay. Now, the reason that can be interesting is because eventually the delineation between practicing with eyes open and eyes closed is less and less. So that you actually are walking around and you can be practicing anytime you want. There are different traditions of Buddhist practice that practice either with their eyes opened or their eyes closed, you know. So the Tibetan tradition and the Zen tradition, they practice with their eyes open. The Theravadan tradition, of which Insight is from, practices with their eyes closed. So there's no one way. But being aware of your body and your breath with your eyes opened is a skill that can't be overestimated or underused. It can be incredibly helpful. Incredibly helpful. Because it can ground us in the moment as we go about our day. It can allow us to touch into what we're feeling and sensing internally. That's why I wanted you to touch, see if you could touch into your breath. Start with that. Even though we're receiving input from outside sources, like another person or, you know, we're driving our car, we're walking around, you know, or the news or whatever it is. Because oftentimes when we're in our life, quote unquote, you know, like the real life as opposed to the practice life, which really isn't separable, but we think it is. But often when we're in our lives, we're going out. looking out, we're addressing outwardly, dealing with this over here, or you over here, or what's over here. Less and less just in here. And eventually, we can do both. We can be addressing what's out here and what's in here simultaneously. And that's a great skill. It's like sort of almost like juggling. It's something that we develop. Now, the reason that this is really helpful is, especially like what I mentioned before we started, is that there are situations that come to us in our lives when we really need to be awake. And there are situations that come to us in our life that we need as much of our facility to be present as absolutely possible, where we don't want to be freaking out, checking out, unavailable. We really need to be here. So one of those situations happened to be yesterday that I wanted to tell you about because it's extreme. And in my mind, you know, I relate everything to Dharma and to practice. That's just the frame of how I see everything now, you know, and you do after a while. So I've been practicing a really long time, decades. So I'm taking a walk near where I live in North Berkeley, and a little bit jet-lagged, because I just spent a couple weeks in New York. And, you know, it was raining and cloudy, and one of those nice kind of quiet days, but I really needed to get out and get some air. And I thought, excuse me, I'm not going to bring my phone. I don't, not that I get a lot of calls or texts and stuff like that, but I just, you know, I just wanted to leave the phone at home, go out in the little rain. It wasn't terrible rain, but, I mean, not real hard rain, but just a little bit of the rain, and walk and smell the smells and be here. So after about a half hour, you know, heading home, I'm about two and a half blocks from my house. And I want to sort of preface this by saying that I grew up on the East Coast. I've lived in New York City a really long time. I was just there. If I could identify myself with a part of the country, it would be New York. I identify as a New Yorker still. I've been here 5 years, which doesn't feel like very long to me. You know, I have a sort of streetwise sense. I've come in, you know, I was there in the 70s. I'll wake you up, or not, a little bit of both. You know, it was a pretty wild time back then, 70s and 80s. And yeah, like I said, I've come, you know, I had some close calls with some things, but you know, I knew how to get around, I knew how to hold my body, and look tough, or what I thought looked tough, you know. Yeah, so you know, I've got my antennas up all the time. So I'm walking close to home, and this guy's walking on the same side of the sidewalk as me, walking towards me, and, you know, even though I've spent most of my life in New York, I still look at people in the eye when I see them walking towards me, you know, a little bit less like a New Yorker in that way. And if somebody looks at me, I might smile. So we catch each other's eyes and coming towards each other. And I didn't, you know, like open my mouth up and smile at him, but you know, kind of gave him a nod or whatever. And I must have looked down, you know, because I didn't want to like stare at him. I looked down and all of a sudden he's right in front of me. Maybe less than a foot away. And I look at him in the eye. And I'm just looking at him. no expectation. And like, hi. And I hear this click. I heard it, but I didn't quite know what it was. And then he says, give it up. Now, I'm naive in some ways, thankfully, in some ways. And when I hear give it up, it's like, give it up for Beyonce. Or whoever, I don't know. No, I don't listen to Beyonce, but you know what I mean. Give it up for the Dalai Lama. So in my mind, give it up is like, yeah. Rock-a-bye. Yeah. So he says, give it up. All right, here, click, give it up. I look down, and there's a nice long knife. So the click I had heard was switchblade. I look down, I see this long knife. I look back up at him, and then I smiled. And I said, what do you mean? I think I probably fucking stunned him. Because he's real calm. And he's looking at me right in the eye. Give it up. And I was like, oh. Then I knew what he meant. You know, I don't know how I knew what he meant, but I figured it out. Probably his tone. And I said, give up what? I don't have anything. And I put my arms out like this. So he pats me down. And I had a big, kind of heavy raincoat on. Wool inside and a wax leather outside. My favorite raincoat, my only raincoat. So he pats me down and I'm looking at him and I'm sort of looking down at the knife. And he didn't feel anything in my pockets. I didn't have anything. I'm at one key. He lifts my jacket up with one hand and he pats my pockets down. There's nothing in my pockets. And I said, I don't even have a phone. And I kept looking at him, and he kept looking back at me, and I thought, this is now I'm going to get stabbed. Because I really looked at him. Do you know what I mean? I think I can ID him. And I had a phone call from one of the Berkeley police right as I was driving here. Said, can you come over here now? We have someone we want you to see if... I said, I can't. I've got a bunch of people. I made a commitment. Can't do it. So, I just looked at him. You know, I mean, what was I going to do, really? He's a lot bigger than I am, obviously a lot stronger than I am, just in mass. He's got a knife. I don't even have a phone. I didn't even think to scream. It didn't occur to me that that would be a good idea. I don't think it would have been a good idea, but it didn't occur to me. And so he lets my jacket go, and he just kept walking. So I thought, okay, I'm going to walk, but I'm not going to run. I'm cool. I'm a New Yorker. I'm going to walk. I walked, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 steps. And then I thought, huh, I wonder if he's got the knife and he's going to come at me when I'm not looking. So I thought, oh, I better turn around. So I turned around. And I saw that he had kept walking and then he took a left. So I kept my pace. I was, you know, just kept walking at the same pace just in case he came and turned around and saw, you know, to watch if I was freaking out or something. And I walked about a block and then I saw a man on his bike, and I said, "Sir, do you have a phone?" And I told him what happened. He didn't have a phone either. It's unusual, isn't it? And, you know, I said, "Well, someone just came at me with a knife, and he's there. Can you maybe..." He said, "Well, I don't have a phone, you know. I mean, I can watch him, but I don't know what that's going to do. Do you want me to walk you home?" Because by that time, I was only a block away from where I lived. I said, no, I'm fine. So I went back home and called the police. That's why I don't have my jacket. They took my jacket in case it has DNA. Which is good. I was willing to give my jacket up, hopefully not permanently, but for the time being. So, you know, it was very, obviously very interesting experience. One I never really thought about having before. I'm not a fearful person, fortunately. And when I mentioned that, you know, the practice, you know, sitting over 100 retreats, eyes closed, going in monasteries, you know, being in monasteries many, many times, my family thinks I'm a little weird, but I'll tell you what, it's for those moments and others that I'm really glad that I've done all I've done, that I've had the training that I've had. Because it's in these moments of extreme something. It could be joy, it could be sorrow, it could be grief, it could be fear, it could be embarrassment, it could be whatever, that we really need to stay as together as possible. That we really need all our senses so that we can be present and sane, present and clear, present and draw upon our wisdom, draw upon whatever we need to draw upon that will help us in that moment to not check out, to not freak out, to not panic. But just to be as awake as possible when we need to be. And also, what's equally as important is that we're not replaying whatever it was over and over and over again. You know how that happens, right? So I called the police. They came over really fast. They're really nice guys. I described what happened, you know, gave them a statement. The first question is, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I really am okay. I was and I am. I'm incredibly grateful I didn't get hurt, because it could have gone easily the other way, as you can imagine, right? I mean, how lucky, fortunate, blessed, whatever, I am to be here tonight with you." Which made it even more evident to me when I walked in and saw all of you here, how great it is to be here with you tonight. Really. Because I might have been in a hospital room, or I might not know any of you at all. Ever. Right? I mean, it's just like that. Life spins on a dime. And so, not only am I not proliferating and creating fear and anxiety around it, because, you know, I know if I wanted to, I could, but I know it would not be helpful. So I'm not going to tell you where I live, but I live alone. And I wasn't afraid. I went to bed, I slept pretty well. It could have gone the complete opposite way, as you can imagine. But I'm not going to spin that around in my mind. I thought about it a few times. Yes, I did. More because I really want that experience to be seared in my mind. Because those kinds of experiences in my life, my way of looking at things, are the experiences that continue to create gratitude for me. I'm so grateful. I was so grateful to have a body in one piece, to be in my own bed, and to be able to wake up. I'm incredibly grateful to be here with you and to be able to share a, you know, bizarre experience, but to put it in this framework so that maybe, you know, you might take something from it. So the teaching of the second arrow, you know, of the suffering we add to discomfort is really important, because if I hadn't trained my mind as well as I have, and I'm not telling you I'm enlightened or imperfect or anything like that. I mean, I'm continually training my mind. But at least I've gotten to a point where I can control whether my mind's going to spin something around a bazillion times or not. I might spin it around a few times. That's normal, that's natural, that's just the way a mind goes. But I don't need to relive that situation 150,000 times, because if I did do that, and we know what that's like when we do, it could have created a very strong sense of fear, a lot of anxiety, doubt, you know, all sorts of emotions, right? By thinking, oh, well, what if? And I honestly want to be able to walk by myself around where I live. So I don't want to create a heightened sense of fear around walking by myself. Now, I might get some pepper spray or something like that, seriously, or, you know, loud whistle or something. You know, I'm not naive. But I'm not going to stop walking around by myself. Now, I could easily stop myself from walking around by myself if I thought about that incident over and over and over again, and if I saw that knife over and over and over again. I wanted to see the knife in my mind because it woke me up after the fact, right? I wanted to see it. And I wanted to be as, and this I didn't have to try to do, but as the experience was unfolding, I was very, very awake, and I was very much in my body. Because when you're not in your body, where are you? Who knows, right? But in some heightened sense of emotion or discursive thinking, yeah? That's not helpful. If you're not in your body, you can't really be completely in the present moment. And when you need to be really awake and on guard, you want to be able to hear, you want to be able to see, you want to be able to feel, you want to be able to sense. You want to use every sense of awareness that you have so that you know what to do when you need to do it. So as I was in my body, as that experience was unfolding, I'm looking at the guy in the eyes. But I also was very aware of how far away we were standing. I was very aware that my heart was not beating fast. That was pretty great. I was sort of surprised, but I was aware that I was aware of my heart not beating really fast. I was aware that I thought, you know, okay, good. I was listening. So if somebody had been behind me, I would have known it. If somebody had walked across the street, I would have heard that. My eyes were very, very open. My peripheral vision was very wide. So I had all my senses, as much as I could muster, at my disposal. And I also knew enough to know that if I fought or I did anything that was kind of silly, it could have led to some harm. He felt my body too. I'm convinced of this. I could be wrong. But I'm pretty convinced of it. Because if you're working or dealing with someone who's really there, It's an entirely different experience than if you're worried if someone's going to freak out on you or hurt you. So my stability and my sanity helped him remain calm. That's how it goes. He didn't freak out. I didn't freak out. If I had freaked out, it would have freaked him out. Then he would have done something that probably wasn't premeditated. I honestly don't think he was out to hurt me, but I think he's desperate. But if I had freaked out or struggled, who knows where he would have gone? You know, we don't want to know that. Anyone test that? So there's basic sanity in being awake that we can't overestimate. Have you ever been with someone that's not mentally stable? You have to be really on your toes because you don't know what's going to happen, right? So, again, by me being, you know, pretty stable, I think it prevented him from being more unstable. And then the other thing that was going on, and maybe this has occurred to you, but and I had dreams about Donald Trump in this way. But the other thing that was going on was that I saw his humanity. And I really felt for him. So he's got a knife held, you know, like this far away from my body. And I didn't hate him. While it was happening, I probably didn't have time to hate him, but, you know, especially afterwards, I really felt like, wow. I mean, when I was telling the cop about the incident, I got really choked up, because where do you have to be in your life up until that point to actually put yourself out in that way? So there's not a lot of happiness there, in other words, and there's a lot more than unhappiness. A lot of confusion, desperation, maybe some lack of parenting, or bad examples, unskillful examples, you know, whatever it is. But he wasn't, like, happy to be doing that to me or anybody else. I heard it happened to somebody else right after me, which is why they stole my jacket. But, so I really, you know, I feel for him. Would I have felt for him the same way if he had hurt me? I'm not sure. I don't know. Or if he'd hurt somebody that I love, I don't know that I'd feel the same way. But all I do know is how I feel now from what happened and what didn't happen. So I feel for him. I can still picture his face. And the only reason I would press charges is so that he doesn't do it again, if I am provided that choice, you know, that option, which maybe I will be, I don't know. If they catch somebody and they want me to ID him, I will. I remember what he looked like. So there was this being present and sane and in my body, of not then rewriting the story over and over, what if, oh my God, next time, oh my God, I can't go out, you know. The perpetuation of the story that would have created fear or anxiety for me now. And then there was also a really wonderful sense of empathy. And I have to say compassion. And it wasn't like, oh, I really want to be compassionate towards this guy. It didn't force that, it just was there. And all of this, I think, really is a product of my practice. It's a product of whatever your practice is, you know, whatever your practice is up until now, is you. You become, we are our practices. They become embodied. They're part of us. And so it's not like, oh, I want my practice to help me now. It just is there. It's just there. Because it's you. So every time you practice, it's accumulating. If it's for 5 minutes here, 10 minutes here, half an hour once a week, it accumulates if it's fairly consistent. And then even in the times that you're not practicing so much, like maybe over the holidays or when you're with friends or something, it's in you. It's there, it doesn't go away right away. It might get a little rusty, but it's not gone. And there's moments like what I'm describing when, you know, you're grateful that you've come out in the rain or you've sat down by yourself and tried again and tried again and tried again, because a lot of practice is that, right? I had heart surgery 3 years ago. You know, and I've always been pretty healthy. Eat well, you know, practice yoga. None of this is a panacea, by the way. But I had some sort of a virus that attacked one of my heart valves, and I had to have it repaired. So for about 2 years, I was having heart failure. It was very interesting. Not at all comfortable. To say the least.
1 star, don't recommend.
Exactly. Don't go back. I wonder why nobody's in that place. But I didn't panic, because I wasn't going like, oh, what's going to happen to me next? You know, I wasn't moving off into the future. Or when I did, in those few moments when I did, I could just easily bring myself back to, okay, I'm not there. I don't know what's going to happen. But I am right here, right now. And for 2 years, that just went on. Then I had my surgery and had a huge awakening, actually. But it was the practice that showed up for me in that regard that kept me really well, even though my body wasn't doing so well. I was fairly calm. I wasn't freaked out. I did what I had to do to take care of myself. And I was really grateful for all the time that I had sat on a cushion or on a chair and practice. Really super grateful. So these are the times, you know, like you'll find when you practice sometimes that I don't really feel like it, or my mind's really too busy, or oh, I should be looking at these emails, or oh, I've got to do this, or I've got to do that. We all know that story, right? Well, just set a time. 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half hour, 45 minutes, whatever. And do it, no matter what's going on in your mind. Because that accumulates. Especially if you can hold yourself in a way that's caring. So part of what I was suggesting in the beginning was just to try to relax and be at ease as much as possible. Because if we can accept that the mind's going to wander, if we can accept that the body might be a little tight, if we can accept that we came in with some feelings or with a busy mind, and that's just the way it is, then we can work with it. If we don't accept it and we judge it and we criticize it, then we fight ourselves. And then it's really uncomfortable. Does that make sense? So if we can give ourselves a light hold or a light embrace and know that everything that we're experiencing is part of having a human mind, human heart, and human body, and hey, you know, welcome to the crowd, then we can work with ourselves a little bit more easily, I think. So I want to open up to any kind of questions that you might have about anything that we've talked about or anything that you might have experienced in the practice tonight. Yeah.
I noticed as I was hearing you share seems like she's really arrived. You know, like, you're describing all these things that really seem like practices, like reaping, like, the benefits of practice. And I guess I'm curious, like, was there a time when you didn't feel that way? I don't know, somehow I feel hungry to hear, like, your story of, like, well, when I first started practicing, just like all of you who are not feeling all these clear, like, calm ways that I'm describing. But I don't know, just so I know.
I was wild when I was younger. I still am, but not in the same ways. I don't know that arrived is something that I would ever say, but I know what you're pointing towards. But there, I think it was about 5 years ago when I started to have heart failure that I knew that I had been practicing in a long time. Because I wasn't freaked out, because I wasn't anxious, because I wasn't depressed, I wasn't afraid. It was like, when I got the phone call from my doctor and she said, you know, I'm really sorry, I have this news, your heart's enlarged, blah, et cetera, et cetera. And I went, oh shit, here we go. But I knew, because I knew I was in for some sort of a ride, but I wasn't sure how that ride was going to be or how I'd be on that ride, right? And so without having to try to figure it out, it just was like, okay, this is my practice now. So kind of it relates to the open awareness or the choiceless awareness practice that it can organically come from practice. Practice is anything you want to use for it. Right? So it can be, you can practice using your breath as focus, you can practice sound on sound, you can practice mindfulness of sensations, you can practice mindfulness of thought, you can practice mindfulness of emotion, you can practice metta or loving kindness, you can practice forgiveness, you can practice all sorts of Tibetan practices or Zen practices. And then there's the life practice, that whatever is happening in your life is what you're practicing with. And after a while, it's all the same. Not in that it doesn't feel differently, that life is bland or one taste, but you're not, the practice is in the moment, and it's all very interesting, actually. So even when something's really unpleasant, it's still interesting. When something's really pleasant, it's still interesting. When something's boring, it's actually still interesting. So there's this undertone of whatever it is, how am I with it? And that's what we work with, is this internal sense and hopefully an openness. And that openness just kind of grows, right? Because I think when we first started to practice, we're kind of tight. I was. And I really had to focus on the breath. I mean, that was the only thing I could anchor myself on. And I just kept doing it over and over and over and over again. And I did a lot of retreat, which makes practice easier, believe it or not. If you haven't done a retreat, do a retreat and your practice will just take off. I promise you. I know it doesn't sound like it should be that way, but it is what happens. But I did a lot of retreats. And I developed a strong concentration practice. And then from there, it opened up. And I was able to take things more lightly because I could see the emptiness of it, the transiency of all things, the impermanence of all things. And so it doesn't matter if you're listening to sound and you're listening to sound arise, shift and change, and pass away. Or you're focusing on your breath. Breath comes in, it does its little thing, and then it passes, and then it comes in, and it does its little thing, and it passes. Or it's a sensation arises, it has its little lifespan, and then it passes. Or it's a thought comes up, has its little lifespan, it passes. A feeling, an emotion comes up, it arises, it shifts and changes, it passes. It's all transient. It's all impermanent, and that's what it is all the time. And then eventually, as you're watching that happen all the time, yeah, you get stuck in solidifying things every once in a while, sure. But as you begin to really experience impermanence as the one thing you can count on, then it starts to erode away the solid sense of self. Because your self is being built on one experience after another experience after another experience. It never solidifies into something. We think it does. The word is think it does. But it's not. And so when the self gets eroded, which sometimes can be a little bit of a scary thought, but when you recognize that you're really not all just what you think, that you're much more than that, then everything becomes a little bit easier. You don't take things as personally, for instance. Everything becomes a little bit more interesting. It's not all about you. That's a relief. And there's an ease. So there's more and more ease, more lightness, a lot more humor, etc. It comes over time. So I think arriving, if there was ever an arrival, would be enlightenment. I'm nowhere near that. That I know. But I think that you do find spiritual maturity at a certain point if you stick with it. And, you know, I'm 61 years old and I've been practicing for 30 years. So that's a good amount of time. In the beginning, I had no expectation. The reason I started to meditate in the very beginning was because I had a crappy memory. And I think I had a crappy, I still don't have a great memory, but I think I had a really not such a great memory because I wasn't paying attention. And then I liked it. And it keeps helping me. And I love Dharma. So there, if you keep doing anything, you get there's ease in something after a while, whether it's playing an instrument or painting or speaking a language or doing whatever the job is that you're doing, or even, you know, just practicing being kind. Eventually you become kind. So whatever we practice, we become. And that's the good news. And it's in these, you know, really interesting, more heightened experiences, I think, that we can say, oh, wow, practice showed up. Not that you plan it, not that you're saying, oh, please practice, come help me, but it just shows up. And then it's not so much arrival, and I know that was just a word that you put on it, but it's a sense of faith. Like, yeah, I've tried this enough times for myself over and over and over again, and I see now what. How this works and how it's helping me and how I want to continue to develop it and why I have complete faith in what the Buddha taught. Complete faith. Not because I believed it when I first heard it, but because over and over and over again, I've tested it out in my life. And now I have no doubt. So it's an accumulation that over time, it might not take 30 years, some of us are faster at things, and some of us are slower at things. And I was a tough nut to crack. But it feels good to finally sit in myself and like myself and be, you know, pretty awake. It feels good, thankfully. So it happens to any of us that try. Yeah.
All right. I started practicing in early 2016, and about 2 years ago this April, I suffered a broken neck and I was paralyzed and went down.
Ooh.
And, you know, people always ask me, I got to
know wow.
about that. They were even starting to go down, and I was totally calm. Was
yeah.
able to communicate to the people what had happened.
Wow. Yeah.
As time went on, that regular practice that I've been doing, it had faded away because my whole focus was basically about rehabilitating.
Sure.
Learning how to do everything from
yeah.
moving my fingers to feeding myself to
Wow. Good for you.
So I fell away from the practice.
Yeah.
And I would practice here and there, but it was very sporadic and it wasn't very good. Of course, another, as you said, that self built up, where I started finding, relying on things that I believed, things that I felt tangible to. Mm-hmm. And it all fell apart, and I had to return to a practice that's like being here from the East Coast. And I'm finding that coming back. That's where my point was. As much as it had come into my life, and in that moment of test, I got it. Mm-hmm. It worked, but it went away. You know, I allowed it to go away, but I did not practice.
Well, I don't think it. I don't know you, obviously, but I wouldn't say it completely went away. There's something that you have retained, or you wouldn't want to do it again. Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Well, and you found a good group to do it with.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes these tragedies, you know, and they really are tragedies, they just give us so much gratitude and they wake us up. There's the heavenly messengers. Have you heard about the heavenly messengers? So they're the ones that knock on your door and say, ha ha, got some news for you. And you're like, oh no. But they can be heavenly messengers because they're giving us an opportunity to really wake up. And that's why anything is practice, if we look at it that way. So I'm sorry you had to go through that. And I'm glad that you went through it. And that you're here. Yeah? And that you can say that and share it. And, you know, our experiences can help others too. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so we have a few minutes, and I won't keep you, but I'll tell you my dream about Donald Trump. I had two. I don't really like Donald Trump, first of all, I'll just preface it by that. I didn't vote for him. I'm really sorry that he's our president. Like, really sorry. However, when we really dislike someone, or hate someone, or resent someone, it doesn't hurt the other person. It hurts us. And so part of my practice is freeing myself of negative emotion when I can. You know, some negative emotion is natural, we feel it, but do we need to harbor it? No, we don't. We have choices about that. So I started working on myself when Donald Trump was campaigning, actually, to see him as a human being as opposed to a big monster. And I was somewhat successful sometimes, and sometimes I've completely failed. And then since he's been elected, you know, I was having a hard time looking at him and listening to him. And I still do. No miracles have been performed here, but I don't want to hate him. I don't want to carry hate towards anyone, really. I don't want to do that to myself. You could even see it as a form of selfishness, you know? I don't want to carry that around. It's too destructive. So, you know, when I see him, I try to see him as someone that's confused and hurting, because I think he is. He wants us to like him, and he'll do almost anything to get people to like him. And, you know, that's kind of obvious by now, right? So I kind of feel for him in that way. I still wish he wasn't our president, but I feel for him in that way. And I guess I've been, you know, doing this consciously and subconsciously for a while, because I had a couple dreams about him in the last 6 months. And the one I really clearly remember was sort of shocking because I dreamt, and I don't normally dream about people that I know or don't know. You know what I mean? People in my dreams are generally nobody that I know. They might represent someone I know, but I don't ever go into it that deeply. But I dreamt that I taught him meditation. And that,
that's satisfying.
Yeah. I never thought about that formally, you know, like, oh, I wish I could teach Donald Trump meditation. It's not been on my list of, you know, goals. But I dreamt that I taught him meditation, and you know, when he opened his eyes after I guided him, his whole face had changed. And he was really happy. And I looked at him and I said, wow, notice how happy you feel? And he was like, yeah. I said, doesn't it feel really good? And he was like, yeah, it feels great. I said, you're so much nicer now. I remember this. And I said, you need to meditate some more. It'll really help you. And he's like, yeah. And I've never really, you know, I still go and I can't really watch him that much. Still, I'm uncomfortable. I don't think he's up to any good, consciously or unconsciously. But I don't hate him anymore. I can strongly dislike somebody without hating them. It flipped. I'm like, oh, phew. And it was not that I would have hated this young man that had the knife in my belly, but it's just that, you know, I think I've practiced trying to build my empathy and compassion long enough that it's actually working. The first few times I practiced metta, I thought it was the sappiest, corniest, most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. Man, me happy. I just didn't like it. And then I did a retreat, and they did it every day. I was like, oh, God. You know, I thought I was going to go insane. I'm a wise-ass artist, New Yorker, you know, skeptical. And it, by the end of that retreat, boy, did I love everyone. Didn't last all that long, but it changed my mind about it. So what you want, what your intentions are, keep them in the foreground and keep practicing. What would you like to include in your life? How do you want to be from now on? These are the choices that each of us has every moment we're alive. And thank goodness we're alive right now. So stay awake. Keep practicing. Be with each other. It's a very, very short, very, very precious life. Let's pay attention to it as much as we can. Okay? Thank you for staying. I know it's a little cold. You don't know me. I appreciate it. I'm glad that you stayed. Hopefully, you'll leave with something. And even if it's nothing that you want to carry with you and go home with, you came. You stayed, which is honorable and respectful. Thank you for yourself and for me. And I hope that I have an opportunity to see you again.